For the record, Joseph Bernstein, I'm representing Justin Burrell. The issue here that we're presenting is limited to Mr. Burrell's conviction for felony murder. And the question here is whether or not the homicide under Williams was in furtherance of the underlying robbery. And the requirement in Williams is that the homicide has to help move the felony forward. And the argument here is that the if you look at the legislative history of the felony murder statute, and in particular the commentary to Section 635, the commentary very clearly points out that there's really a logical disconnect between a reckless state of mind and the in furtherance of requirement. And I quoted in our opening brief at page 11 the particular paragraph in the commentary to 635, and the comment is basically that there's simply a logical disconnect between the requirement that a killing be reckless and the in furtherance of requirement. And
now, you're focusing on the reckless state of mind because there was not a conviction for intentional murder.
That's correct.
Okay.
In the trial, the state made a very persuasive argument that this killing was intentional. And in fact, the state's argument was that the killing itself took place at the very end of the robbery scenario. And I don't want to put words in the state's mouth, but the closing arguments quoted extensively in our brief. And the thrust of the argument was this was an intentional killing because it was completely unnecessary. It didn't have to happen.
Well, let me just make sure I have the argument down.
I'm sorry.
Let me just make sure that I had the argument down correctly. If the murder or the homicide was intentional, then there would at least be the factual foundation for an argument that the defendant killed the victim in order to prevent her from resisting the robbery, which I suppose would be, you know, in furtherance of, and I think that's, if I remember correctly, the rationale that the trial judge used in his opinion.
Well,
is that right?
To be honest with you, if Burrell had been convicted of intentional murder, and he was not, he was convicted of manslaughter.
No, I understand.
We wouldn't be here.
Okay, and the reason is that there would then be a factual foundation for the argument that the killing was in furtherance of the felony.
Well,
yes or no?
There would not be a fact. If the killing was intentional, there would not be a factual basis for this argument.
Why not? Which argument?
The argument that the killing was not in furtherance of.
Right, and the reason is that because there was no finding of an intentional homicide. At most, the homicide was reckless, and it doesn't make any sense to argue that the defendant killed this woman recklessly in order to further a robbery.
Well,
that's the disconnect, isn't it?
Yes. Our point is that logically, you can't recklessly further something.
So does that mean that the jury necessarily, setting aside the issue of inconsistent verdicts, that the jury necessarily found an intention under the felony murder charge?
Well, the jury did not. The jury convicted Burrell of manslaughter.
I understand that. Charge, and there may... Is it possible that there could be inconsistent verdicts?
Well, I don't think it's a question of whether it's an inconsistent verdict or not. I think that's beside the point, whether it is. Our point is that you can't have, as a matter of law, a reckless killing that furthers something.
Well, let's suppose hypothetically you're pushing someone along on a staircase or somewhere else in furtherance of a robbery. And as you're pushing the person, they fall and die because of the nature of, you know, the interaction with them. In my hypothetical, I'm trying to paint a scenario where you're clearly trying to further the robbery, but it results in a death because of the reckless nature in which you're pushing the person along. Help us distinguish a case like that.
I suppose it's possible to create a scenario, and the example you gave is probably a good one, where let's say the defendant punches the victim, and 999 times out of 1,000, punching somebody is not going to kill him. But this particular victim has a glass jaw, and he falls down, cracks his head open, and dies. Factually, if the punch, even though there was no intent to kill, was part and parcel of the robbery, there would be at least a decent argument, I would agree, that even though it was unanticipated and unintended, furthered the robbery.
Well, here,
but you still have the logical disconnect.
I understand that. What I want you to help the court understand in this case is if you're robbing a person at gunpoint and you're brandishing the weapon, and let's suppose you were even hitting the person with the weapon, you know, you say, hurry up, get the money, and the gun discharges and the person's killed. Why doesn't that state of mind justify a conviction for a killing in furtherance of the robbery?
Well, I suppose if the jury were instructed properly, the jury would have to find that the reckless conduct was in furtherance, that the whatever conduct the defendant engaged in was with the purpose to further the robbery.
And your concern in this case about the instruction is the use of the word assist.
Well, it goes part and parcel with the in furtherance of requirement. Arguably, that instruction at the time of Burrell's trial may have passed muster. After Williams, it clearly doesn't, and especially the use of the term in furtherance of or assists in the commission of the felony. Our argument here is that when you use the word assist, it casts a much wider net than in furtherance of does. You can commit a homicide that assists in some way without necessarily being in furtherance of. And
well, does assist, is that the equivalent of moving the robbery along, that phrase?
I would say no. I would say if you look at the way that an average reasonable juror would interpret the term assists as being much broader than the term in furtherance of. You could assist something without necessarily having it meet the in furtherance of requirement.
Other than this case, can you give an example?
I think
that?
This case is a perfect example of that.
The difficulty with the facts in this case, as I understand it, the victim was trying to retrieve something, the safe, from under the bed. And that's when the person was killed. Is that right?
My understanding is that the safe had already been found.
No, located. But
not have been in Burrell's possession.
Right.
But it was, he knew where it was.
But at least either the safe or its contents had not been delivered to Burrell when the gun discharged.
That, I believe, is correct.
So we have a situation where the victim is actively engaged in retrieving the object of the robbery and the gun discharges.
Well, my understanding is that the victim showed Burrell where the safe was, and Burrell was standing over the victim, and the gun was pressed against her head, I believe. And according to Burrell,
it wasn't the victim kneeling down or somehow crouching
was kneeling,
down,
was
to,
kneeling down
to retrieve
correct.
The item from under the bed.
Correct. And Burrell was standing behind her. And according to Burrell, the gun just went off. And apparently,
and my question is, when, however you characterize it, it seems to be a fair statement that the robbery was in progress when the gun discharged.
The robbery hadn't been completed.
Right.
That's correct. I agree with that.
And your argument, focusing on the fact that this was not in furtherance of the robbery, relates to the state of mind.
Well, I think the requirement of state of mind applies to all of the elements of felony murder, including the in furtherance of requirement. And the point, I guess, that I'm trying to make is that logically, and it's supported by the commentary to 635, a fortuitous killing that is totally fortuitous, and that's what the jury believed in this case, can't logically recklessly further something, a robbery, a rape, whatever it is.
Mr. Bernstein,
yes.
Let's go back to the beginning of the robbery. That is, the defendant knocks on the door. The victim opens the door. The perpetrator pulls out a gun, points it, at the head of this woman while he's dragging her along, and they go to the bedroom. Now, during that interval of time, wouldn't it be fair to say that the gun was being used in furtherance of the robbery?
I'd say the weapon was being used in furtherance of robbery, but the requirement.
Well, I said it was a gun.
For felony murder is
that. Was the gun being used in furtherance of the robbery? Your answer was
yes.
The weapon was.
Yes.
Okay. I gathered the answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay. And when this woman at the direction of the defendant with a gun pointed to her head went under the bed to retrieve the safe, before the gun went off, the gun was still being used in furtherance of the robbery, correct?
Yes, I agree with that.
So under your view of the law, it was only when the gun went off accidentally that it stopped being in furtherance of the robbery. Isn't
well,
that right?
The killing has to be in furtherance of the robbery, not the display of a weapon. That's robbery first degree. If you display a weapon in the course of taking somebody's wallet.
Well, he didn't just display a weapon. He used it. Pointed it to her head and threatened to kill her.
I use the term display in the sense that however it's used, whether it's pointed at somebody, pressed against their head, that elevates robbery second degree to robbery first degree.
Well, let's go
but
back.
The focus here is on the killing and not.
Let's try another hypothetical.
Right.
Let's suppose you're trying to rob someone and you ask for the money, and they say they're not going to relinquish their money. And you throw them into the wall, and the idea is to intimidate them further into relinquishing their money. But going back to your scenario, the person, is the very susceptible to injury and dies. When you threw them into the wall in an effort to intimidate them into giving up their money, you were doing that in furtherance of the robbery. But you seem to be suggesting that since you never intended to kill them, you just intended to throw them against the wall so they'd be intimidated and then relinquish the money, that the killing did not occur in furtherance of the robbery.
I think that's right. And logically, the argument is you can't, and I think the legislature cured the problem from 2004 forward by eliminating the in furtherance of requirement. the original felony murder statute eliminated the state of mind requirement with respect to the killing. So you can have either one, but when you have both things, both of these elements in the statute, there's a logical disconnect that virtually prevents almost in almost any scenario, and especially here where even the state was arguing the robbery was the killing was an afterthought.
Do you want to save your...
I'm going to save my time. I see the yellow lights on. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Williams.
Hey, good morning, Justice Holland and Justice Jacobs. Justice Ridgely, may it please the court. I guess there's actually three different arguments that are being made here. The trial judge, in his decision rejecting this second post-conviction relief motion, appears to have only addressed one of the arguments, the sufficiency of the evidence argument, that is, whether or not the evidence that was adduced at trial in 1999 was sufficient under Williams to establish that the killing of Dolly Fenwick, the shooting of Dolly Fenwick in 1998, was in furtherance of the underlying felony, that is, a robbery for the felony murder charge. The trial judge correctly, I think, indicated that the evidence certainly was sufficient, that that was the whole reason for having the weapon. The weapon was being held at close range to Dolly Fenwick's head as she was crouched on William Davis's bedroom. He rented a bedroom in this mobile home from the Fenwick family, and she was pulling out a safe where Mr. Davis kept his money and was attempting apparently to put some money and the safe in a book bag or backpack that Mr. Burrell had brought to the home that morning for purposes of taking away the robbery proceeds.
But why doesn't the judge's determination that the evidence was sufficient also constitute a determination that the state of mind argument that we're hearing is not valid?
Well, I think it does. I think if you have a broad reading of that, it certainly does that. And I think even if you even if this court starts anew and looks at the evidence, I think the evidence is sufficient here. The argument, I guess, that's really being urged more strenuously on the court is that the Delaware felony murder statute, at least as it existed up to 2004, that statute somehow is legally defective, and that all of the people we've convicted under that statute, that their first-degree felony murder convictions would be in question.
Well, that's why I'm having trouble sorting out Mr. Bernstein's argument about state of mind and the sufficiency of the evidence, because as I understand the request of the Superior Court, it was exactly what Mr. Bernstein argued this morning. He said, given the conviction for manslaughter rather than first-degree murder, we have a determination regarding state of mind. And if you look at the statute, in furtherance of, you can't further a felony murder with a reckless state of mind. Therefore, there's insufficient evidence to convict this defendant. And the court rejected that, and the Superior Court specifically looked at the facts, as we've discussed them, that the victim was kneeling down by the bed, the gun was being used to held to her head, and the gun discharged. So at least in my mind, I don't see it as two separate arguments. I think if the Superior Court was right on the sufficiency of the evidence, it also made a determination that there was sufficient evidence to support the state of mind to satisfy the in furtherance of requirement.
Well, I think that's probably true. I mean, the trial judge does make findings of historical fact, but at the same time, after making those, he then applies the rationale in Williams and says, well, all of this conduct, however it's characterized as reckless or whatever, did move the felony along, the felony being the robbery, and that's all that Williams requires, even though Williams was decided after this prosecution in 1999.
Can you help me with these issues in the sense of, are we to evaluate what the verdicts are on other counts, and as a result of that, try and extrapolate a set of facts that the jury must have found, and then apply that set of facts, apply the felony murder statute to that set of facts? Or do we just look at what all of the evidence was, and if there is evidence that would support a felony murder conviction, regardless of what the verdicts were on other counts, that that's the test? And if there's, in other words, that if a jury, maybe not this particular jury on the manslaughter point, but if a jury from the evidence could find that he actually intended to kill in furtherance of the robbery and convict on felony murder on that basis, is that enough?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's the latter interpretation, because the verdicts do not have to be consistent. Here, I think there is some consistency, because to convict him on manslaughter, they found that Mr. Burrell acted recklessly. And in order to convict on the first-degree felony murder, the required statutory state of mind was also reckless conduct. The jury was instructed on accident, which I think is probably what the commentary is more appropriately addressed to, but they rejected the accident defense. So the jury, at least we know the jury did not find that this killing was an accident. What you can surmise from the verdicts, and the only one that's being attacked really is the first-degree felony murder verdict, is that the conduct was reckless, and the jury was also instructed that they had to find that this conduct of the actor, Mr. Burrell, was in furtherance of the underlying felony of robbery, and that's what the jury found. The evidence was certainly sufficient for that. The trial judge elaborated on that in ruling on the post-conviction motion.
Well, Mr. Bernstein seems to proceed from the opposite premise, that is, that you can't that the court has to do more than simply look at whether the evidence was sufficient to support a finding of, I guess, intentional conduct. And that, on the contrary, the court has to take into account what the jury's factual findings were on any other charge, and then apply that finding, I guess, as a binding factual finding in order to evaluate whether or not the evidence was sufficient. If we start with that premise, that is, if we assume that Mr. Bernstein is correct, his position is still subject to the argument that, at least to the extent that Mr. Burrell was using a gun in the way he did, that gun was being used in order to further the felony of robbery. And the fact that it went off accidentally shouldn't make any difference. The response to that argument, and this is my question, Mr. Bernstein's response to the argument is, yes, but the issue is not whether the use of the gun was the key fact in furtherance of the felony, but rather whether the killing was in furtherance of the felony. Do you have a response to that argument?
Well, I don't know that the killing necessarily has to be. It's the reckless conduct, whatever that is, and the reckless conduct, I think, is the using of the gun. I mean, Mr. Burrell's explanation was that he didn't think the gun was loaded. Of course, he also concedes that he never checked to see if there was any bullets, and he claims that Mr. Scott, the co-defendant who was tried separately, had told him there weren't bullets, but he's still holding the gun against her head. He doesn't really have a clear explanation as to how the trigger is pulled. He says that he thinks she moves or something like that.
Yeah, but that's all evidence that goes toward the intentionality. Let's assume, just to make sure that we're on the same page here, that the court, in determining whether or not the evidence of felony murder was sufficient, that is, whether the evidence was sufficient to support a felony murder conviction, must assume that at most Mr. Burrell was acting recklessly at the time the gun went off.
Well, I think they have to assume that. That's part of the felony murder statute, and that's true regardless of the manslaughter verdict, even though that also required a reckless state of mind as well.
Okay. Well, the argument that you're confronted with is how can someone recklessly further a robbery, that is, how can someone recklessly kill a victim in order to further a robbery?
Well, I think it's just you look at the sum total of whatever the conduct is, and all the reckless element relates to is the state of mind of the actor. He does not have to be acting intentionally in order to further the crime. If he was acting intentionally and the homicide resulted, it would simply be a first-degree murder. And the felony murder statute casts a broader net, and it has a couple of purposes. One is simply to deter felony conduct, and secondly, if people act recklessly, which is the statutory required state of mind, and that there is an underlying felony, the conduct of the actor is in furtherance of that, that's sufficient to constitute the first-degree felony murder crime. So I think given the evidence in this particular case, that was sufficient. It wasn't an accident. It's not a fortuity, as the commentary seems to be discussing. If it was, then that would be a different case. But the jury was instructed on accident, and they rejected that. So this isn't an accidental killing. There is purposeful conduct. The jury did not decide that it was intentional, the discharge of the weapon, but they decided it was at least reckless conduct. That's all the statute requires, and under the evidence in this case, I think it was more than sufficient for the jury verdict. The commentary is not the law. The statute is what the law is. Statutes are presumed to be constitutional, and this court's responsibility when confronted with an attack on the constitutionality of the statute is to construe the statute in such a fashion as to save the statute. The issue that's presented here really calls into question all of these felony murder convictions that we've had in Delaware since 73, I guess, when the code was enacted, up to 2004.
Well, how would your analysis work with regard to the classic felony murder situation involving the getaway driver? Let's take the exact same facts we have here, except suppose Burrell had an accomplice waiting outside to get away. We have the death occurring during the course of the robbery. When the felony murder law is focusing on the getaway driver, we're focusing on the fact that the person was driving the car in furtherance of the felony. Is that right?
Yes.
In looking at the guilt of the getaway driver, the law doesn't look at the circumstances under which the felony occurred inside the convenience store, the house, or anywhere else, does it?
No, and I think the reason for that is the footnote 33 in the commentary. It's at the bottom of page 192. It says the felony murder rule has always given rise to intricate problems of accomplice liability. And that's the complicating factor you have when the getaway driver is not the shooter. He doesn't, in fact, even go in, but he's outside. And because of accomplice liability, he is still deemed to have the same responsibility and criminal liability as the people who do go in and do cause the death. So I think while it may seem a step removed because of the accomplice liability, the getaway driver still has the same responsibility.
Well, let's go back to the other argument in this case. Let's suppose the facts support a felony murder conviction. Mr. Bernstein says the instruction to the jury was erroneous, and that in and of itself requires reversal.
Well, I don't think the instruction was erroneous. What the judge did, he added the language or assist, but jury instructions, as long as they are reasonably informative and allow the jury to perform the jury's responsibility and function, That's all that's required. You don't have to mirror the exact language of the statute, and the words are interpreted given their normal meaning in common parlance or verbal discussion, I think some of the cases say. And given the facts in this case and the jury instruction in total, it's an or. They could have gone either way. We don't know which. The jury instruction was still sufficient for the jury to reasonably do their job in this particular case.
Mr. Bernstein says that assists is broader than in furtherance of, and that you can pull in that net conduct that would not violate the statute.
I don't know if it is or isn't. I mean, that's a semantic distinction. You know, when do you move from something being in furtherance of to assisting? It seems to me that the terms are synonymous, and I think that's what the trial judge did in giving the instruction. He was trying to give some reasonable common sense guidance to the jury as to what they had to find in order to convict Mr. Burrell of the felony murder instruction. And the jury obviously looked at the evidence. They decided that even though there was a strong argument by the state that it was an intentional killing, they rejected the guilty verdict on the intentional murder charge and only found Mr. Burrell guilty of manslaughter. Now, Mr. Burrell was 17 at the time of the crime, so you don't know if the jury was giving him some break or not. Sometimes the way that seemingly inconsistent jury verdicts are reconciled is by attributing it to jury leniency, and we simply don't know because the jury doesn't explain how they arrived at their verdict here. But I think it can all be summed up in the fact that the jury rejected the accident defense. They certainly found that Mr. Burrell was acting recklessly because they convicted him of both manslaughter and first-degree felony murder. And given the facts in this case and the way the law, at least as it was in 2004, that was sufficient and that the jury instruction gave sufficient guidance to the jury in order for them to make those proper factual findings.
Just so I'm clear, the accident defense was raised as defense to both the intentional murder and the felony murder charge?
I don't know. I don't know if it was ever that finally defined. I think the argument was just that the shooting was accidental. I mean, presumably that relates to both because the shooting is a part of both the intentional murder and the felony murder. If you don't have the shooting, you don't have a felony murder. So I guess in that sense, it's related to both. And the jury
wasn't the defendant's position that he thought the safety was on or that it was supposed to be on? Something.
I think it was that, and he thought that there were not bullets in the gun. I think he said either at the police interrogation that was recorded or at his actual trial testimony that Mr. Scott had told him that there were not bullets, although he conceded that he didn't actually check to see if there were or were not bullets in the gun. If there's any additional questions, I'll certainly attempt to answer those. All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Bernstein, can you help me with this issue? Let's assume that all the other charges except felony murder fall away, that this case only went to trial on a felony murder charge with this evidence that was presented in this case. Under that circumstance, is the evidence sufficient to support the verdict?
Well, I don't – yes, in general, to answer your question, but – our attack is not on the sufficiency of the evidence. Our attack deals with a defect in the felony murder statute that was pointed out very clearly in a comment to Section 635, was presented to the Superior Court here and not even addressed, was presented again in this court and not addressed by the state in its brief or in its argument. I didn't hear any argument by the state that our point about the defect in 635 is wrong. The state says
that defect again?
That there is a logical disconnect between the reckless requirement and the in furtherance of requirement. And if you read the comment, the Section 635, that's exactly what they say. And they even trace the history of how the felony murder statute was changed at different points, and their point was the final version doesn't make any sense. I think that's correct. That was a correct observation then, and it's still correct. Now, it's been cured since 2004 because one of those two requirements has been eliminated. You could eliminate either one and cure the problem. But the problem, as it existed in this state, in this case, at the time of this trial, was in existence.
So as a result of that problem, no one can be convicted of felony murder?
Well, I'm not going to say that, because there might be a case out there where, under some factual scenario, the problem might go away. So I'm not going to say categorically nobody could ever be convicted of felony murder, but I will say in this particular case, under the factual scenario here and the jury's finding rejection that this was an intentional killing, coupled with the fact that the state was really arguing that the killing itself was an afterthought.
Well, how do you address Mr. Williams' suggestion that the comment is not binding, it's the text of the statute that's authoritative?
Well, it's part of the legislative history of the statute. And I think this court has, in the past, at least in other decisions, cited the commentary as highly persuasive authority for legislative history. So obviously the court can back away from that, but I think if you look at all the decisions where the court has cited the commentary, the court has cited the commentary in an approving way and has given a lot of weight to what the commentary says. The jury instruction, Mr. Williams is correct, jury instructions have to be informative, but this was a jury instruction that was not informative. Under the facts of this case, the argument could very easily be made that the assist language was put in there to cover this type of situation where the jury might have a problem with saying it was really in furtherance, especially based on the state's argument. The state was really saying this was an intentional killing that didn't have to happen, that didn't serve any purpose. And they're certainly, it's self-contradictory to say, by the same token, well, it was in furtherance of the robbery. And that's the problem that the state has here.
Thank you.